We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
From Illinois Public Media, this is Focus on AM 580 and online at will.illinois.edu. Good morning. Our technical director is Jason Croft, the producer for the program, Harriet Williamson. My name is Celeste Quinn. Today we open the phone lines for questions about computers. This is a topic we take up once a month on the first Thursday of the month. Debbie Flieger and Jim Eyrick of CITES join us this month. CITES, the acronym for the University of Illinois Campus Information Technologies and Educational Services. Jim is a wireless network designer at CITES. Debbie is a network engineer at CITES. Listeners, you can join us with a phone call or by email this morning. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number, that number 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. And the email address is will-talk@illinois.edu, will-talk@illinois.edu. Jim, Debbie, good to see you again. Welcome back.
Thank you.
Nice to be here.
Yeah. So one of the things I wanted to talk with you about is passwords, because it seems almost every day recently we've seen all kinds of reports about hacking and places, organizations, institutions that you would think should know better are being hacked. So what can you tell us about that? What do you suspect is going on? And then maybe you can tell us a little bit about making sure our own passwords are strong and safe.
Well, there's the hacker group Anonymous that's targeting various cause or companies and organizations, trying to penetrate their systems, and have successfully penetrated several systems, Sony being the big one. There was another one that's since been supposedly retired that did some damage. You know, I think that under most systems, under enough coordinated attack, you're probably, there's a hole somewhere, and it probably only takes one. Mm-hmm. You know, defense in depth is the key term for security systems. Obviously, these companies had some issues. There's not much that as an end user you're going to be able to do to make some company save your password better. I can tell you something that these recent events have caused me to do, which is I'm now going through and every website I use a password on, it's a unique password, which is a real pain, but they're random. I'm not going to remember them off the top of my head. I am using a password manager, but I am actually going through and not using. I used to have four or five passwords, kind of use them from different sites, depending on if they were financial or if they were just entertainment websites, things like that. But now, pretty much every website I use, I'm assigning a unique password to that website.
And so you're using a password manager. You want to talk a little bit about that? How do they work?
So a password manager in general is tool that helps you organize passwords, and what it does is you'll have one master password that all your passwords for all the different ones that you save are in an encrypted file, and then you have one master password that you type that then opens that encrypted file and gives you access to all the passwords you've saved. You should make that one master password a good one. I prefer passphrases if the program will allow it, so that you can have 20 or 30 characters. And passphrases aren't as difficult to remember as if it was a random 30-character password. But as far as anybody actually trying to hack it, to them, as long as you don't pick common phrases, don't use things from the Bible or any other well-known publication.
Don't use the quick brown fox.
Yeah, things like that.
Every good boy does fine.
Exactly. Make up something funny that is unique to you that no one else would come up with. And then as far as somebody, if they get a hold of your password file, and try to attack it using a brute force password method, it's going to seem like to them that it's random characters, even though to you it's not, and it's easy for you to remember.
Okay. Now, do these things, does the password manager, does it live on your devices, or is it stored online, or both?
You could either or, different programs, different things. The current one that I'm using is an open source one called KeePass, K-E-E-P-A-S-S. And my only, or my password file is saved on a USB key in my pocket. And I only stick it in the computer, type in the master password, and open that file when I need to get to something on it. Now, I do have a backup on another key in case something happens to that one, because you wouldn't want to lose where all your passwords are. That'd be a real major pain, even if you could go through and do the password recovery where they send you a link to your email or you have to answer some security questions. Sites also, and I can't think of the name of it off the top of my head, Sites does license a password manager for all university. Everybody that can get the free web store stuff that's covered under the university licensing, there is a password manager available through the web store at no cost.
Okay. Do they have vulnerabilities?
The password managers?
Yeah.
Oh, they probably do. One of them would be is anytime you have to look at something and open it, if your machine is compromised, if you can get to that password file, you stick it in your computer, and you can open the file, then if they have your machine or if they're somebody's doing a keylogger, they could get your master password file. That's one of the reasons that I try to minimize that by keeping my password file on a USB key that's not normally plugged into the computer and I only plug it in when I need to get to it, is that hopefully even if they do password capture or a keyboard keylogger and they get the master password, that normally my password file is not actually accessible online at all.
Hmm. What if you've heard news that your credit card company has been hacked and that information has been taken from a million different customers? Is there anything that you should do in order to look into that, or just sort of sit back and hope that they
A lot of times, if someone has actually, you know, a big company's gotten their information stolen, I know somebody that had theirs done, they actually will pay for like 6 months of one of the services to watch your stuff for you. And you go in and you set up the account, and sometimes you close out the account that was stolen. Sometimes you don't. It depends on what the severity was, what the likelihood of it is. But then you get a service that watches your credit report and things like that for you, looking for any unusual activity, so that because it was in a theft, you want to pay more attention than otherwise. You know, or if you can decide to just close your account out, you decide how much of a hassle that is for you, and make your choice. Yeah.
And I recommend that people actually spend time with the government. Allows you to download, or they made a law that forced the credit reporting agencies to allow you to download and look at one of your credit reports, I think once per year, I think is what it is. Or there's a website. It's probably like Get Free Credit Report. If you type that into Google, make sure it's the actual. There's some other ones, organizations out there that'll give you your credit reports for free if you sign up for their credit monitoring service and things that then does cost. Mm-hmm. But there is a service that at least once a year you can download one of your credit reports and look at it. And you can go through it and go, well, those aren't, those accounts should be closed. And then call the credit company up and say, hey, I asked you to close this account. You're not showing it closed. I want you to make sure it's closed. And you can also look at who's pulled your report, so you know if somebody's trying to get credit against your name and you're like, I didn't ask for somebody to try to get a loan for me for a new car, kind of stuff.
Yeah. This is Focus. Good morning. I'm Celeste Quinn, and today we're talking about computers in this portion of the program. Debbie Flieger and Jim Irick are with us this morning. They're with Sites, the University of Illinois Campus Information Technologies and Educational Services. And listeners, you can join us this morning with a phone call or by email. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. And the email address is will-talk@illinois.edu. Let's go and take a call now from a listener in Champaign on line one. Hello.
Yeah, how are you?
Fine, how are you?
Good. Is your alphameric, is that used just that, or a combination of numbers, or you were talking about login?
It depends on whatever the site will allow me. Some sites only let you use alphanumeric. Some will let you use caps or not. Some will let you use special symbols. A lot of password managers will actually let you choose when you have it generate a random password for you. Well, you can choose which character sets that are allowed to be part of the password and then also the length of the password. So I will actually try to pick the maximum allowed that the company allows and also the maximum number of character sets that they allow. Since I don't have to remember it anyway, I don't really care if it's tough to type because I'm just going to copy and paste it from the password manager. Another nice thing about using password managers, at least the one I'm using, is that there's a set time that if I say copy password, it'll actually erase it out of the clipboard after 15 seconds.
Hmm.
So then you can't even accidentally paste it into something later.
Hmm. Hmm. And the other issue, in the state of Illinois, you can do a freeze on your, for your credit report. Nobody can go in and do the credit and all. You know about that, right?
No, I'm not actually aware of that.
But I think if you're over a certain age, it's free. And so if anybody comes in and tries to, in other words, open up an account or, a credit card or this other thing, it won't allow you to do it, and it stays on there permanently. For an individual under a certain age, I think maybe it's $10 or somewhere initially.
And this is through the state of Illinois?
Mm-hmm. They made it some of the states... allow this. Other states don't allow it, but, sometimes we do a good job in Illinois.
So they force the credit reporting companies by state law to allow a customer, a consumer to do this?
Yeah, you can freeze, in fact, all three of them. And then actually you can get a sort of unfreeze it or whatever the word be, maybe for a day or some or other.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, you go to the bank and you want to get a loan or some or other, and then it goes back on. But it's something worth
thinking about.
You can go on and find out. But the thing where they create a problem is each one of them has a different way you can do it. You know what I mean? In other words, procedure.
Mm-hmm.
And in other words, some of it's by mail, some of it by whatever. But you can look up each individual reporting agency and actually freeze your account.
Very nice.
Interesting.
And I also, a listener reported in that annualcreditreport.com is one site that allows you to get in. Once every 12 months, you can pull up one of the credit reports from Equifax, Experian, or TransUnion.
Mm-hmm. You can also do that on this one, too. In other words, you could look up your account once a year, But somebody ought to look into it because really, because every time, there's been a breach someplace, you're sort of panicky. But if you have it frozen, nobody can get the credit. Now, in terms of the credit, your credit card, they can run that for a while. But, that's protected by your individual credit card company, what is it, $50 or something or other. But for people trying to get on and trying to get another credit card or trying to take a loan or all this kind of stuff, your account's frozen. So it's well worth looking into.
Well, thanks for the call.
Yeah.
This morning. Let's take another call from a listener in Champaign, line 2. Hi.
Thank you. Hopefully you can help me. I have an elderly Mac, which I'm tending to replace when the I'm kind of holding out till the new Mini comes out, and so I'm kind of hanging on for a while here. But I've been having a problem with my email program crashing often since a while back. I was awakened in the middle of the night with the fans running on my computer like a really, really high. I've never heard them run this fast before. Usually I'm not even aware of them. They're very quiet. And I couldn't get the screen to come on. I couldn't, touching the power buttons on the monitor or the computer itself wouldn't get the computer shut off. Finally, I just unplugged it and, left it until morning and then plugged it back in. It, I was able to run it again. I haven't had that problem since. But since that time, I've had this problem with my, mail program just like several times a day. If I refresh the screen or anything, it'll crash, 6-7 times a day.
Well, it sounds like something got corrupted when your machine crashed. So what you described, if the processor locks up, say the kernel panics or something, whatever reason the machine crashes, as the temperature gets hotter, the fans go faster and faster. But because the software is not working, it never slows things down. You know, the processor's stuck going really hot. Letting it cool off, you know, if nothing else is going wrong, you know, your hardware doesn't sound like it got damaged, but it sounds like something in your mail program got corrupted. You didn't say which mail program you're using.
I'm using the Apple's mail program.
Okay. So it stores its files in your library folder in two directories, most of it, mail and mail downloads. The downloads are just the attachments. That's unlikely your problem. There could be something, you know, a single email message file that got corrupted in your mail directory. You could also have something in the preferences setting for your mail that's corrupted. But the first thing I'd do is, if you haven't already, is run your disk utility and have it verify the file permissions. And also, you know, just check for disk errors. Be sure it can't find anything for you and fix it. And then, if that doesn't help, then the hard part is figuring out, you know, which thing is actually corrupted, whether it's a preference file or an actual mail message. If it's running 10.5 or 10.6, it'll store the mail messages as individual files. So if you can narrow it down to, you know, oh, this folder's always open when it crashes, or my inbox is always open when it crashes, you can see if you can, you know, narrow it down to a specific message and delete that message and see if that helps.
Okay. Yeah, it's a pre-Intel computer. I got it like 2005. So it's, you know, I can't even run the most recent 10.5.8, I think, is what I have on here now, which is the most recent operating system I can run on this machine. So it's pre-Snow Leopard. So you'd say run disk utility and see if that will take care of the problem.
Yeah, both things, the permission repair section as well as the actual disk verify part. You can do the permission repairs even if you're booted from your local partition. You can verify the state of the hard disk if there's any problems or not. While you're booted from it, if it says there's problems that it needs to repair on the hard drive, first be sure you've got a backup, and second, then you boot from your install CD and run disk utility while you're booted from the CD, and it should be able to repair the hard drive. Usually it's got a pretty good chance of repairing whatever got corrupted. If it doesn't find anything there, then you're searching for an individual corrupted mail file or mail preference.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome. This is Focus. We're talking about computers today. Listeners, you're invited to join us with your questions. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Toll free, 800-222-9455. And our email address is will-talk@illinois.edu. When is the new operating system from Apple? I think it's called Lion. When is that coming out? Announced?
They said July. They haven't said when. We're in July.
Yep.
There's been developers versions out to people on their seeding program for a while. So really, they're not leaking. You know, I heard a rumor that was going to be the 6th, but I don't think it happened yesterday. So I think we would have heard.
We would have heard.
But so any time between now and the end of the month,
okay,
there'll be some unhappy people with Lion. That's one of the interesting things is, you know, in 10.6 they dropped support for the PowerPC hardware. You could only run it if you had Intel hardware. Well, with 10.7 they dropped support for the PowerPC emulator called Rosetta that lets you run your older applications that were designed to run on a PowerPC. They won't run anymore under 10.7. So if you've got a universal binary that was written to run on either or an Intel specific binary, it's going to run fine under Lion. But they've been very clear that you won't be able to run your old PowerPC programs.
Okay, so I think I know part of the answer to my next question. When does it make sense to upgrade to a new system?
It really depends on your need case. If you've got something you absolutely have to run that's a PowerPC app, you're not going to upgrade to Lion, not until you find a replacement for that app. I would not jump on the very first release on your primary machine if you've only got one machine. I'd give it a few days, read the blogs of the people that tried it early. As with any brand new system, some things are going to be wonderful and it's going to have some bugs. I in general encourage people usually to wait for the first patch of most operating systems. That's not a Mac specific thing. That's a general version. You know, the stuff that you couldn't quite catch with your developers and your early seeds, suddenly you've got thousands or millions of people using it and you find those last, 10 or 15 critical bugs and you get them fixed in that first patch.
Okay. Let's go back to the phones. We've got a number of people waiting for us. Next, we're going to go to line four, caller in Belgium. Good morning.
Good morning, all. I have a question very similar to just what you talked about. I run a small business, and I use QuickBooks. And I have a fairly old version of QuickBooks. And here in about the last 6 months or so, when I go to back up my information, it says I can't back up to a disk because I need to be the systems administrator. Well, since I'm the only person doing anything, I obviously am the systems administrator, and I couldn't figure any way how to fix it. Well, I've talked to a couple other people about it, and I may have it figured out, and it may be a kind of an insidious little problem here. I understand that QuickBooks, or Quicken, maybe I should be more specific, say Quicken, as things get pretty old, they have little shut-off switches in there that after a version gets old enough and they want you to buy a new one, okay, in 2011 June, it quits. And therefore, it's not something so critical that you can't use the program anymore. It just makes it a little bit less user-friendly to encourage you to go out and buy a new version. Have you heard of this before?
Intuit, which is the company that actually makes Quicken and QuickBooks, certainly has some of their online services where they will stop supporting older versions of the software. I had this happen. I use QuickBooks for my business, and I don't know. I probably had, like 2007 or some version of it, and it stopped supporting their online download of your credit card activities, and you had to upgrade to 2010 to do that. I have not heard of any feature inside of the program that actually stops working, just the ones that interact with Intuit's websites. As far as the administration, that error actually is possibly related to some security patch that Windows put in place, or if this is a Mac. Are we talking about a Windows machine?
No,
or
it's a Windows.
It's possibly actually a Windows change that was done to the operating system. One thing you could try is the next time you start up, you said it's actually Quicken, right?
Yes.
Is to right-click on it and say run as administrator. And give that, and then go to backup. I do not recommend that you run it as an administrator all the time, but that's one thing to try, is that they're actually different depending on which Windows operating system you're currently using. Windows 7 has more of it, and Vista is the one that really added this stuff in. Is that there are certain privileges that unless you actually tell the program to run as an administrator, it runs as a least privileged user. And the reason for that is to protect the system from possible worms or infectious programs, is that even if you are logged in as administrator, the programs you're running may not be running with escalated privileges. But you can right-click on the icon and choose run as administrator and then see what that happens. This may be specifically possible if you're making your backups to the root of your hard drive.
Well, actually, I try to make them to a disk so I can, obviously put it someplace else.
And it depends on the disk. You might try making a subdirectory on that if it's a USB key, or is this actually a floppy?
A floppy type thing.
I don't know what the rules are on accessing the root of a floppy. I don't buy machines with floppies anymore,
When I say floppy, it's, one of those CD, like a DVD, a CD disk. That's not exactly a floppy,
Okay.
That's what you're talking about.
Well, and so now we're talking about, you're actually talking about a piece of optical media that you're writing to and then going to burn for later?
Exactly.
Okay, so that complicates stuff even more.
Oh.
So, without knowing the package and have it in front of me, I don't think I'm going to be able to help with that specifically. What I would try to do is back up to a different location on the hard drive. Mm-hmm. So like in drive C, make a thing called Quicken Backup.
I do that.
And then go into Quicken and try to down backup to that folder. And then copy, if it successfully makes the backup, take that backup and then try to burn it to your optical media.
Okay.
My other suggestion is to, unless that you're actually using this optical media for archival purposes, is you might find it wise to invest in a $10 USB key that you can just stick in there and it shows up as a drive letter. Burning to optical media can just complicate things that when you're having problems that can be easily replaced by just using the USB key. You also don't burn out. You're not throwing away media after you burn it, because USB keys reusable read-write for a long time before they start to go corrupt. So I would try making the backup to the other place on the hard drive, and then if that doesn't work, try. And it'll actually give you an error. It'll say, hey, you're backing up to the same drive that the data's on. You go, yes, I know. It's okay, because you're going to back it up. You're going to copy it somewhere off that hard drive later. And then the other thing to do would be to try to see if you can run the program as an administrator before you try to do the backup.
Thank you very much, sir.
You're very welcome. Thank you for the call. And next, we're going to take a call from a listener in Chicago. Line 1, south side of Chicago. Hi.
Good day. Good morning. I should say it's almost noontime. I got a quick question for you, and I'm not really a big computer person, so maybe you could help me out with this situation. I've got a Hewlett-Packard a laptop, and I've got a Hewlett-Packard printer. And the printer's not obeying my commands, the print in gray, and I'm using a lot of ink with the color. It's going to color all the time. What I did to try to correct that, I erased the program that came with the printer and then reinstalled it. I did that 3 times, and I still can't get it the printer to obey my command, the print in gray.
When are you asking it to print in gray and black and white, or
gray shades? On the ink, you know.
It's what? Yeah, no. When? How are you actually telling it to do that?
I'm just on the computer. I think it's probably Windows or whatever. When it's I put the arrow over to the computer to the printer, and I have a choice to choose color, grayscale, or regular black.
And so this is actually when you do a print job, or are you going into the printer ahead of time?
No, just when I want to print at that time.
Interesting. I don't think I've heard of this. The only thing I think of is make sure if there's an apply button after you checkmark the box that said use grayscale to make sure you hit apply so it's actually accepting the command.
Okay, I tried that. I've done that. Like I say, I erased the program that came with the Hewlett-Packard printer. It's a D4260. And reinstalled the program and did that 3 times. I'm still having the same problem. And I'm thinking,
Well,
I can't get a hold of anybody from Hewlett-Packard to tell me how to correct the problem. And it's just using up a lot of color and ink.
Sure. No, I understand that. You know, I hate to use this fallback, the only thing I can think of off the top of my head is to go to HP's website and not download the program, but actually download the specific driver for the version of Windows you have and upgrade to the newest printer driver. Because, I mean, this sounds like a printer driver problem, that the printer driver is just not accepting the fact that you say, hey, print in black and white or grayscale. Otherwise, I've not run into this. I really don't know. I'm at a loss. Possibly is to Google and see if there's anybody on a forum somewhere that is experiencing the same problem that has worked it out.
Right. I've got Vista, and I heard a lot of bad things about Vista, so I don't know.
I'm actually, before Windows 7 came out and after Windows Vista Service Pack 1 came out, had no problems with Vista at all. I think it got a bad rap early on. And it was actually, by the time after Service Pack 1 came out, it was which goes back to what Debbie said earlier about you don't want to necessarily have this first operating system, version of an operating system before any service packs come out. But I don't think Vista is the actual cause of the problem in this case. I had a laptop for a year and a half that had Vista, and it didn't do things like this. Everything was fine. Make sure you do have Vista Service Pack 1. That is important. Although I still would have a hard time believing that the operating system would cause a printer driver to not print in black and white.
So a quick search on Google.
Everything I should do as far as following procedures, and I'm going to properties, and then properties, I go to color, and you choose color, black and white, or grayscale. I hit grayscale, I put apply, and it prints color every darn time.
So a quick Google search found somebody with the opposite program where it won't print in color, even though the test page shows the color was perfect. It always printed in black and white, and they said that if you click on printers and then you right-click on your printer and choose printing preferences, there's a color tab, and there's a box that says print in grayscale. So they thought maybe perhaps this user had that checked because they were getting gray instead of color. You might try checking that, and it's not as nice as saying it on a per printout basis. You might go see what's checked on that tab and see if that helps any.
I'd appreciate that. I even went so far as pulling out the colored ink box from the printer, and then the printer wouldn't work.
Right.
Yeah, no, they won't work.
All right. Well, I appreciate it. I'll try what you suggested.
Okay. We wish you the best of luck. If you've just joined us, this is our monthly hands-on program about computers. More after a short break. This is Focus.
On the next Fresh Air, Jose Antonio Vargas, a former Washington Post reporter who recently revealed he's an undocumented immigrant. When he was 12, his mother sent him from the Philippines to live with his grandparents in the U.S. He just founded a group that supports immigration reform. Also, Mark Krikorian, who directs a group that supports strict immigration enforcement. Join us.
This afternoon at 1 and this evening at 7 on AM 580.
This is Focus on AM 580 and online at will.illinois.edu. I'm Celeste Quinn. Jason Croft, our technical director. We're talking about computers today with Debbie Flagger and Jim Eyrick of Sites at the University of Illinois. Let's go back to the phones and take a listener who is online, too, in Urbana. Hi.
Hi, thanks. I got a problem with my computer. Started about a week ago. It seems like when I first started up and click on programs to do stuff, mostly email, web browsing, and the such, I get a lot of the pauses in the program where the program will, if I click it too many times, say not responding, and get the little circle spinning around. And maybe 30 seconds, a minute later, it will finally click in and start working again, and then I continue to have those problems with programs, in the beginning of the day, but seems to lessen as the day goes on. Did virus scans and spybot scans, and nothing showed up, so I don't know where.
This is while using a browser?
Yeah, right. Browsers are always up. Yeah.
And which one?
I use both.
That doesn't help me. There's more than two.
Yeah, well, Explorer and Firefox.
Thank you. So one thing that this, and I run into this on my own machine, is to try to troubleshoot this, is to go in and at least the newest versions of both browsers allow you to go into what's called add-ons or extensions, mm-hmm. and disable them selectively.
Okay.
I would start by disabling them all. Now, not uninstalling them, disabling them. And then it may ask you to reboot. You close the browser, basically reboot the browser, right? You close the browser, restart it, I guess, and then see if you have the problem, and then turn on one extension or add-in at a time, and do the same thing until you run into the problem.
Okay.
And then if through that troubleshooting, trial and error elimination, you're able to find that one of the add-ons is causing you a problem, either decide whether you can live without it. Go check to find out if there's an update, or search on the internet and see if somebody suggests there's a fix for it or not. You'll be surprised about the number of add-ons that exist in there that probably you can actually live without. You're like, oh, I don't need that, and you just dump it. I've done that recently in Internet Explorer. There were some things, and interestingly enough, the new Internet Explorer, the version 9, actually gives a little report that said, hey, one of your extensions took a long time to finish and tell me that I could return control back to the browser back to you. And it actually gives a little report that says this extension used up 1 second, took a second to execute, as opposed to the rest of them where it says it took, an eighth of a second or something like that, or, even less, a hundredth. And I was like, well, I don't really need that extension. Uninstall, and that solved the problem.
Yeah.
So I would definitely start with blaming add-ons for this.
Okay.
Often it is, I find it to be one of the, unfortunately, the Adobe either Acrobat or Flash, which I don't want to live without. So just make one of the things to do is to make sure that you actually have the newest versions of all those. And the newest versions of Acrobat Reader would be, I believe, version X or 10. And you may actually have to go into your control panel, add remove programs, and uninstall, assuming you don't need any of the old versions, the 7, 8, or 9, to actually uninstall previous versions of Acrobat and then install the newest version.
Yeah, it also happens when I'm running OpenOffice. I get the same thing, and I've had trouble downloading and installing the latest version of OpenOffice. Caused all kinds of problems with my computer, and they kind of work themselves out.
Make sure that Java is also up to date. And then I also go through and I install to the newest version or update to the newest version of Java, and then actually go back and go into add remove programs and uninstall any of them that are older than the newest one. Because for compatibility reasons, it'll leave older versions in there that you may not need.
Okay.
Unless you have specific reasons to support a specific version of Java, for compatibility reasons, my suggestion is to uninstall all the older versions.
Oh, okay. I've seen those. I wondered about them.
Well, I haven't had any adverse effects on my machine, and I can tell you that's how I do it. So.
Okay. All right.
Thanks for the call this morning. Let's take another call. A listener on line 3 in Urbana. Good morning. Line 3? No, let's try an email question. I am running Windows 7 on my computer, and my Windows update settings indicate that Windows update has been disabled by your system administrator. I'm logged in with admin privileges. To the best of my knowledge, there is only one profile on this computer, and I'm the one who installed the OS, so I'm confused about how this could happen. I've run checks for virus and malware, and everything appears clean.
Wow. I don't know. Google. That's what I'm going to have. I'd have to spend time doing on this one. I really don't. I mean, I'm assuming that the machine is not a member of a domain. I don't think the person says.
No.
But I suspect not. So I don't know where that would come from. But I would definitely use Google search to see if anybody's run into that. My first suspect is that this actually is a malware problem. Some malware has installed away so that it doesn't get up to date, and so that Microsoft can't release something that then fixes however it got into your machine. Otherwise, I just don't know how this would happen. It's quite possible it happened some benign way, but I don't know. Try to make another administrator account and log into that person and try to enable it and see what you get from there. That's about the only, besides Google on this one, or your favorite search engine, I should say. I'm at a loss.
Yeah, the only thing I can think of is if it was on an AD or something like that and somebody, pushed a policy out, but that doesn't make much sense.
Not in this case, certainly. If it's not a member of an Active Directory, then... That's the only way I would have seen that I would have seen that in the past would have been if it was pushed through a policy.
Okay. Let's go back to the phones. Listener in Urbana, line 1. Hi. Line 1? Should we try line 2? And we'll see what the problem is. Let's see if we can go back to line 2, Urbana. Hi.
Hi, Celeste. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you. Go ahead.
Yes, I just wanted to bring up a new unique problem what I have come across in the couple of days before. I was using a Dell E series computer with Windows 7. What happened is suddenly one fine morning, selectively few keys, the number keys as well as the combination of letter keys are disabled. I tried to log in to my website or to email or anything, and I tried to enter my password. I certainly, because of the loss of functionality of the few keys, I could not enter any of the passwords as well as I could not access anything. So the whole system is crippled. I don't know whether the sites have come across with this kind of unique situation and whether they are able to rescue this. But I do run McAfee IE87, virus protection software on my system. If you could suggest me what would be the best way to handle this, that'd be great. I haven't even tried the safe mode startup yet. I will stop and wait for you. Thank you.
Well, safe mode startup's always a good thing to try. I think a new keyboard or borrow a keyboard from somewhere is a good thing to try too.
Yeah, that reminds me of what happens when a connector comes loose in a keyboard, like inside the case, so things aren't connected quite right. Some keys work, some keys don't.
Yeah, so those are the two things. Safe mode startup's always a good thing. That disables a lot of the startup stuff to see if something's causing something to go wacky. But in this case, if keys stop working, I think the first thing I do would be grab a friend's keyboard for 10 minutes, plug it in, and see if you regain functionality of all your keys.
Okay, the listener has rung off, and I hope that helps. I think that should help a great deal, and we wish him the best of luck. And let's go take another call. This is a listener on line 3, Urbana. Hi.
Hello.
Hi there.
Yes, can you hear me?
Yeah, go ahead.
Apparently, 2 or 3 times you haven't been able to hear me.
I don't know.
I can hear you.
Yeah, I don't know what happened.
Yeah, so, anyway, we're working now.
Gremlins.
I developed quite a fondness for McAfee Site Advisor, and I use Firefox. And there's been a compatibility problem over the last several versions. 3.6, I think, worked, and the early 4 didn't, and then 4.1 or 2 did. 5 currently is not compatible with Site Advisor. Is there something comparable that you could advise, or should I switch to Chrome? Or
beyond what's built in and what Google provides through their service, search service, I don't know any. There are other things that are comparable, but I don't use them, so I can't be familiar. I don't even know the names of them. I just know that some of them are out there. There is something else you can try. This is an add-on that I've recently started using, so I could use Google Toolbar inside of Firefox 5, and it is called, as soon as I get it up here, it is called the Add-on Compatibility Reporter. It's a Mozilla add-on, and it actually allows you to run toolbars that are add-ons that are incompatible with the version of Firefox that you're currently running.
Okay, so that's the Google Add-on Reporter.
Not Google. It's just Add-on Compatibility Reporter.
Add-on Compatibility Reporter.
And that's available through the Mozilla extensions for Firefox downloads. The only reason I even found out about it was I run Google Toolbar, and when I upgraded to Firefox 5, it said, hey, you can't use this anymore. And I'm like, really? Come on. So I went and searched, and I found some people that said, if you use this, this will let you work around this problem. Now, if there's a general incompatibility with the version, if Firefox makes a change in the way things add-ons work, it may not function. I mean, it may not be able to trick it into working for you.
Mm-hmm.
But in general, a lot of toolbar incompatibilities are actually related to just versioning checking. I've actually gone so far as to take the add-on package, and there's instructions for this on the net, because I think they're actually zip files. You can just rename them to .zip and open them up, and you can go in, find the text that talks about checking compatibility, and increase the maximum version number allowed, and then save it all back together, and then you can then it'll say, yes, it's compatible. Now, there's a reason that compatibility checking exists. So by doing that and bypassing it, you might actually cause a problem. And it may not work, or it may. I'm not going to be responsible if your browser goes up in smoke. But those are the things that you can actually do. And I found that the add-on compatibility reporter worked at least well for Google Toolbar.
Well, I'll have to give that a try. It was comforting to look at a Google search and see green flags and the occasional red flag, and know you stayed away from the red flag.
Sure.
I'm not sure of how often they check. They seem to be checking the sites quite often, but I suspect it wasn't infallible.
Sure.
But thanks for the advice.
And we're going to take another call now, a listener in Urbana. Line 1. Hi.
Hi.
Go ahead.
Yes. I have a pop-up, a Norton pop-up, telling me that I need to renew my Norton. But I already have another. And every time, it's just there. It won't go away. How do I get rid of that pop-up?
Add remove programs and then uninstall any Norton antivirus or security suites that are listed. If you're using some other antivirus program, McAfee's or Microsoft's or some other one, then you don't need to have two of them anyway. So just go into add remove programs and look for the stuff that says it'll either be Norton or possibly Symantec. And then it'll be like security or antivirus, and uninstall those. All right.
Okay. This is Focus. We're talking about computers. We've got about 5-6 minutes left in this portion of the program. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. The email address is will-talk@illinois.edu.
You know, another thought for the person with a messed up keyboard, if you didn't think of it, check that caps lock and num lock keys aren't pressed or stuck down.
Or the shift key stuck down, actually, while we're talking about those things.
You know, if those are
bring up a notepad program, and so you can use your mouse to do that, and start typing and see if you can figure out if it's not getting keystrokes or if something's stuck, right?
Yeah.
Okay. That's a good thought. I like that. Okay, let's take another call. I think, well, not quite ready yet. So I have been asked to ask you, Debbie, about Mac Cleaner. It's a utility. What does it do? What's it good for? I don't know. Someone just said, could you ask Debbie about Mac Cleaner?
Well, I'll have to find out what it is. Let's see.
Oh, okay.
Mac Cleaner downloads at CNET. Mac Cleaner software for Mac OS X. Who makes it?
It's not an Apple product?
It is. Nope. This brings up something called Mac Keeper. Clean up and protection from your Mac, free up disk space, boost your Mac speeds, increase performance. A lot of software does leave cruft around.
Cruft?
Extra bits.
Okay.
Little pieces of data sticking in places that you don't need anymore. You deleted the application, but it left the preferences file and things like that.
Okay.
So there are programs that can go through and, you know, try and match those things up and get rid of the extra. You know, it really depends on what it is you're trying to get out of it. You know, here's one called maccleaner.com. And boy, it's got a picture of a windshield wiper wiping your iMac. You don't need that, that's for sure. It really depends on what you're trying to do. Apple and even Microsoft as well have worked really hard in their very latest operating systems to really clean that stuff up. You know, it used to be, I can remember having to defragment my hard drive regularly and things like that. They build that into the operating system now. You know, they reorder the files. They keep it nice and neat. There's a lot of stuff they do. For most people, I'd say you're as well off to, you know, next time you get the newest computer or you upgrade your operating system, make your good backup, wipe the hard drive, install fresh, and move your settings back over every once in a while. And that really works for what most people need.
Okay. Let's take a one last call this morning. We'll have to be brief, though. Line 1, Danville. Hi.
Hi. Good afternoon. I keep getting on my computer, when I'm trying to close out Internet Explorer, it will just say there's a problem, and it just kind of shuts off that screen. And I'm not sure why it does that. It doesn't do it in Mozilla, but it does it, you know, when I'm on the Internet Explorer.
Again, like the previous caller, I would check your add-ons. So you can go through and disable the add-ons for the browser. They're also like browser helper objects is another name for some of those, and clean up some or disable or remove some of those and see if it stops doing it. See if you can have a pattern where if it does it always when you're at a certain site or doing a certain function like opening up a PDF file. What version of what operating system and what version of Internet Explorer do you have? Do you know?
I think I have the latest one. I upgraded this not too long ago. I know I have Mozilla 5.
Right. But Internet Explorer, depending on what you have, you could have probably version 8 or.
I think I have version 10.
Okay. I have no experience with that because there's way too many scary things that say we're not up compatible with version 10 yet, so I've stuck with 8 and 9 on some of my machines.
Okay.
If the problem happened when you upgraded to 10, you might want to see if you can actually downgrade it, uninstall that, and go back to 9.
All right.
I have not spent any time troubleshooting version 10 at all. Sorry.
All right. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome. Thanks for the call this morning. Any last word or two of advice here? We're going to have to wrap it up pretty
regarding
quickly.
Regarding cleaner stuff in general, on both, no matter what brand of operating system you have, and I've talked about this before, in general, I'm not a fan, especially when you're doing it as just, oh, it's something to do kind of thing. Exactly. I've seen people mess up their machine and have to pay somebody to come fix it more often than not using those cleaners. I think that they can do good, and there's been some stuff when I'm working on somebody's computer and trying to clean up a program that did not uninstall correctly that I'll actually use some of those. But in general, it's Friday night, it's time to run the computer cleaner, I would not do that. Unless your machine's actually showing problems, getting slow, or you're getting errors, I would stay away from doing those out of just a matter of habit.
Okay, very good. Anything else, Debbie?
Well, one of the things I came across as I flipped through that cleaner site was some good advice, though. Uninstall applications you don't use, clean up the system log files, those kinds of things that you do yourself.
You don't
use an application to do them. And empty your trash.
Empty your trash. All right. Well, with that, we'll leave it until next month. We'll talk once again about computers, hands-on computing, coming up in August. And we do this program on the first Thursday of the month. I'm Celeste Quinn. This is Focus. Coming up, we'll have a market update and news as we begin the afternoon magazine.